This episode of AstronomyCast is brought to you by Swinburne Astronomy Online, the world's longest-running online astronomy degree program. Visit astronomy.swin.edu.au for more information.
AstronomyCast, episode 204 for Monday, October 25th, 2010. Temperature. Welcome to AstronomyCast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. My name is Fraser Cain. I'm the publisher of Universe Today, and with me is Dr. Pamela Gay, a professor at Southern Illinois University, Ebersville. Hi, Pamela. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today, Fraser?
Doing great. Of course, when this is being recorded, or I guess when people listen to this, we will have finished our presentation in Washington, and I will be flying back to Vancouver. So I hope it went well.
Here's definitely to hoping for that.
Yeah. So we're going to answer a question that a four-year-old might ask. What is temperature? Why are things hot and why are they cold? How hot can or cold can they get? And how is this all important to astronomy? All right, Pamela. So when we think about that temperature, right? Like I reach out with my hand and I touch a piece of metal and the metal is hot or the metal is cold. What's going on?
Well, at the most fundamental level, if you could get down and peer at things at the level of electrons and atoms vibrating molecules, what you'd see is that metal is filled with atoms and electrons that are a little bit excited to be alive and are vibrating their little hearts out, zipping around, moving quickly within the metal. And it's this combination of motions and the energy those motions can then transfer to your hand that, well, that's the hot part. Or if they're not moving at all, that's the cold part.
But in both cases, they are moving.
Yes.
And so like, you know, so just to think about that situation, you got the cold metal. They're still moving and they're still giving off energy. And in the hot, they're still moving, what, faster? More vigorously and still giving off energy, right?
Exactly. So hot stuff is fast moving, cold stuff is slow moving. And at the end of the day, when we talk about temperature, what we're talking about is nothing more than how particles are moving.
And if we heat the metal up really hot, it turns into a liquid.
Right. So in this case, we're breaking down bonds. Atoms, they tend to clump up, and they do this in ways that we give the words covalent and ionic to. And these are just fancy ways of saying they're sharing electrons in different ways. And these bonds, well, just like if two people start running across a field together and get out of sync, their hands will tear apart if they're holding hands while running. Two atoms, if you heat them up enough, their motion will break the bond that's holding them together. So when we chill things down, we're allowing them the opportunity to share electrons, to bond together into solids. And when we then heat them up, we're loosening those bonds, making them more fluid, more like square dancers who switch partners as they go round and round. And if you heat something up enough, it becomes a gas. And now there's no connections between the atoms at all.
Right. They're free to flow around and fill up whatever space they're inside.
Exactly.
You could blow up a balloon with iron gas.
a very
special balloon and a very, you know,
exactly.
Yeah. But in, you know, all of the elements can go through those phase changes. So then are there limits to temperature? How cold can you get?
Well, basically we're limited by how much energy can an object give off so that eventually it's, for the most part, sitting there going, yeah, okay, I've got nothing left here. And so we talk about this as the term absolute zero. This is the point where you have cooled an atom so much that all of its electrons are in their lowest possible energy level, and the atoms really don't have any kinetic energy that they can impart through collisions. They're just sitting there.
So have they completely stopped moving then?
The electrons are still in their lowest energy level. They're still slowly chugging their way around the atoms. But this is a different state of matter that we can't actually get to. And So yeah, there is motion, but it's not useful motion that you can have collisions in.
Right, I see. So you there's still motion there, but you couldn't get any more energy out of it.
Right.
And so then, but this concept of absolute zero, it's like it's theoretical, right? Because we happen to live in a universe and we could never hit it.
Well, it's not so much a condition of our universe as we don't have the ability to get something isolated enough that you can achieve absolute zero. And we don't have a way to suck all the energy out of something. This is one of those hard to think about things. It's easy to heat up a room. You flow electricity through a set of wires. The wires heat up and they shed their energy into the room around them. Energy naturally goes from hot to cold. You can do a whole lot of different things to heat a room up. You can light something up on fire, and the energy that's stored in the molecular bonds will get broken down, released as energy, and you have a warm room. But the only way to really suck energy out of something is to, often we use various pressure rules by you can expand a gas and the energy is now spread out over a larger volume. And this is kind of weird and funky, but if you imagine spraying yourself with a can of canned air, the air that comes out of the canned air is always cold. And this is because it suddenly gained space to move around in. So its energy got spread out, its temperature dropped. Now we have to take cold stuff that we make cold through various, usually pressure interventions, and flow it through something slightly warmer. So the cooling tubes in your refrigerator, they're not giving cold to your refrigerator. What's happening is the warmth that you let in when you open the door, that warmth is flowing into the colder tubes. Now, to get something down to absolute zero, that means you have to somehow get something colder than absolute zero to like suck the energy out, because the energy will flow from warm to cold. And we can't do that. So we're stuck.
So how cold have scientists got temperature? I know we can't hit absolute zero, but how close can we get? And how do they do it?
Well, we can actually get within fractions of zero. Most things that we deal with are within a couple degrees of zero. This is where we start talking about Bose-Einstein condensates and this cool extra condition of matter that we create in laboratories that doesn't behave like a solid, doesn't behave like a liquid, doesn't behave like, well, a gas or a plasma. But in our pursuit to keep making things cooler and cooler, using techniques that either involve magnetic cooling or laser cooling, we essentially stop particles in their tracks. And by trapping them in specific resonances, we can get them to lower and lower temperatures and get them to behave in new and fascinating ways. That what's kind of interesting is the universe itself is warmer than what we're creating in the lab.
Right. But in this case, you've got like a handful of particles that you've cooled down to that temperature, not a block of metal or a block of ice, you know, it's
right.
Yeah. But it's, you know, theoretically. Okay. Well, that's the cold side. Then let's turn things around and look at how hot we can get. How hot can we get? Is there an absolute high temperature?
Not so much an absolute high temperature as we eventually just sort of run out of the energy to get things that hot. As we look out at the clusters of galaxies, the pressures are so high that atoms are in constant collision. And these constantly colliding, heated up by various effects from jets from black holes and other different effects, this shock-heated, jet-heated, compressed-down gas, it can get to billions of degrees. It's giving off gamma rays. It's giving off X-rays. And we're not exactly sure the absolute limit of how hot something can get, but we know that things can get very hot, and the limits on heat are simply the limits on how much energy can you inject into a system before that system starts expanding out. That's the problem you run into is you heat something up, the atoms start moving around and they start breaking out of the area that they're in and expanding to larger and larger volumes. So you have to both hold the material in and heat it up at the same time.
Right. I can imagine you blowing up a balloon with gas that's millions of degrees. It's going to have a lot of energy and really want to expand that balloon.
Right. And this is where when you start dealing with pressure containers, when you fill up a container of oxygen gas, of any type of gas, the gas gets hot as it goes in, and these containers are always at high risk for exploding. Don't ever drop a compressed air cartridge because it can go boom with a lot of violence. So you have to have both the containment and the pressure to get to the high temperatures.
And in a practical sense, I mean, this is used in fusion power, in fusion power experiments here on Earth. I mean, you don't have to look all the way out into the middle of the universe to find some really high temperature gas. I know that's one of the conditions they use for trying to replicate fusion here on Earth.
And this is one of those fascinating things where we mentioned a few moments ago that we use lasers to cool things off. Well, fusion actually uses laser to heat things up. And what's happening is you're taking all of this light, often from more than one laser, focusing it down on a very small point, often a little tiny glass bead that's specially seeded with other elements. And the pressure that you can create with this light is what's generating, hopefully, fusion.
Hmm. But even, say, the center of the sun is like 15 million degrees Kelvin. I mean, there's some pretty hot temperatures out there. So then if there isn't a maximum theoretical temperature, what are some of the hottest things in the universe?
Gamma ray bursts. Basically, the bluer the light, the higher the temperature. This is one of those things that is really confusing to beginning introductory students. When you look out at the universe, when you see something red, that's a cool object. Just like your red hot burner on your stove may seem hot, it can also get white hot, and that's a whole lot hotter than the red hot.
Right.
So as we look across the universe, it goes from red as nice, cool stars to yellow as warmer stars to there aren't green stars to big blue flaming hot stars. And as we get to shorter and shorter wavelengths, as we get bluer and bluer, such that we're passing out into the ultraviolet, the gamma ray, and the X-ray, that's a reflection of the temperature going up. And one of the ways that we measure temperatures is by looking at the color of the objects in the sky.
And so the highest energy things out there are these gamma ray bursts, which in some cases can let off more energy in a few seconds than their entire galaxy is giving off.
Exactly. And that's the other side of this, is these extremely short wavelength photons that are getting released in these very high energy events. They carry a lot more energy in them. So you can have two photons, two identical particles by name side by side. But if one of them's a radio photon, no big deal. It can pass right through you and you're not in danger of death. But that gamma ray photon, that one gamma ray photon can bust up a piece of your DNA and potentially trigger cancer in the future. So gamma rays are highly dangerous because of how much energy can get imparted in just one photon of light.
And it's this energy that's moving with photons that can then be transferred back to mass, to matter, and you get temperature.
Right. So it's through collisions that, in some ways, all the magic happens. As light from stars, from exploding stars, from a variety of different sources passes through gas, the different constituents of the gas each absorb light at their own specific frequencies, their own specific colors. We've talked about this some before, where atoms have specific allowed, and I'm just going to keep using the word specific, have their own specific allowed transitions. So you might see one set of lines that corresponds to hydrogen, another set of lines that corresponds to carbon monoxide. And we're able to tell what atoms, what molecules are in a cloud of gas by looking at the specific colors that are absorbed out of that gas. Now, at the same time, though, you can also have a bunch of dust particles. And dust, it's happy to absorb light at all different colors. But put together, we're able to figure out what our universe is made of.
And I guess this was the next big question is how do astronomers use temperature in their studies? What does temperature tell an astronomer? And how do they determine temperature?
Well, determining the temperature is a matter of looking for these atomic transitions and looking more importantly at which ones are stronger and weaker. So if I'm looking at a star that has a whole myriad of different atoms in it, stars are mostly hydrogen, some helium, and then trace amounts of other atoms, of metals, titanium lines. However, even though this is a very small fraction of the star, these atoms are able to just suck light out left and right. So when you look at a stellar spectrum, it's just riddled with these titanium lines. It's riddled with iron lines. And we know that when you heat these metals to certain temperatures, they start losing electrons. And the set of lines that you get directly corresponds to what electrons are present, which corresponds to temperature. So I can look at something and go, okay, I have this set of titanium lines, which occur at temperatures between A and B. I have this set of iron lines, which occur at temperatures between D and E, where D actually happens to be colder than B because I'm using strange numbers. By looking at all these different parameter spaces, you sort of get a Venn diagram where when you overlap all the different possible temperatures for this set of lines, that set of lines, this other set of lines, it allows you to focus in and say, often within just a couple hundred degrees, exactly what the temperature of the surface of a star is. With gases, we can do the exact same thing. We can start to tell what is the temperature of the gas in terms of what atomic transitions are taking place.
And so without those other chemicals mixed in with the gas, would it be really difficult to tell? I mean, I know that, for example, astronomers can find cold neutral hydrogen.
Right. And the thing with cold neutral hydrogen is it at least has the dignity to have what we call a spin flip, where when we look at this hydrogen gas, occasionally the one sad lone electron associated with that hydrogen gas, it'll decide it wants to flip on its head. And this small little very rare transition, we can see that energy. We can see the energy given off when that spin flip occurs. And that allows us to map out where the gas is located. It requires radio telescopes, but that's okay. We have radio telescopes.
But once again, we're really just using that property of the matter to give us an idea of the temperature. We're looking for places where this is happening, and that tells us what the temperature is.
Right.
Are there other situations? What about finding temperature here in the solar system?
Within the solar system, we get to use an additional part of physics, the black body concept. This is what you see when you watch really old Star Treks and Captain Kirk shines a laser beam, shoots his phaser in all reality at a rock, and the rock heats up red. Well, what's happening is as the rock heats up, as the elements on electric stove heat up, the atoms as a population are increasing in temperature, and some of them are going to be hotter than others, and some of them are going to be cooler than others. And if you were to make a plot of color versus how much light is given off at that color, is you get some things that are bluer than others, some things that are redder than others, but the majority of the light coming off will be at one central color. And the shape of this distribution is what we call a black body distribution. It's a little quicker rising on one side if you make a plot, a little slower tapering off on the other side if you make a plot.
I mean, there's a good analogy with light bulbs. Certain, you know, temperatures give off a cool light or a warm light, and that's following that black body curve. I know you get, you know, I forget what the exact temperature of a light is, but it's like 5,000 degrees.
And if you have a dimmer switch, as you dim your incandescent light bulb, which you shouldn't be using,
as you dim your LED array.
Yeah, that doesn't work. As you dim, you shouldn't be using it incandescent light, it gets redder. And as you increase the electricity flowing through that filament, it gets hotter and the light itself gets bluer. But if you look at it through a prism or through those funky glasses that you can get that make everything into rainbows at carnivals, what you see is it's actually a full rainbow, but the majority of the light is coming out at one color in the rainbow. And the shape of this curve, the shape of this black body distribution, is directly related to the average temperature of the object, the black body temperature of the object. And so when we look at something and we measure very carefully how much light it gives off across all the colors of the rainbow, by looking to see, oh, this one gives off most but not all of its light in the blue, it's hot. This thing gives off most but not all of its light in the red, it's cooler. We can very accurately get the temperatures of rocks, of planets. Now, there's caveats. Rocks aren't perfect reflectors. So there's going to be colors they don't reflect so well, colors they reflect better than others. So we have to correct for all of that using chemistry, which isn't fun, but we can do it to figure out the temperatures of different objects.
And so we have a set of tools. Astronomers can look for the really, really hot stuff. They can look for the temperature of stars, and they can also figure out the temperature of objects right close to home in the solar system. And I suppose when they land spacecraft right onto those worlds, like the Mars rovers, they can actually use a thermometer.
Right. And all the thermometer's doing is when you get it cold, the mercury is going, or the alcohol, depending on what type you have, is going, oh, I'm cold. I'm not going to move very much. I'm going to compact myself down and be very small. But when you heat it up, the motions increase. And with that increased motion, it takes up more space, expands out. And so we're just looking at how things move.
And at the end of the day, that's really all the temperature is the motions of atoms and molecules.
It's kind of simple to break down. It's some of the ugliest quantum mechanics you'll ever see.
Yeah. Yeah. That's...
But at the end of the day.
I mean, they only really understood what's going on within the last 100 years, right? Thanks, this Einstein.
this isn't so much Einstein. Temperature predates, but it's only with the advent of quantum mechanics that we're able to understand at the atomic and molecular levels exactly what's going on and relate temperature to vibrations, to spins, to the flipping of electrons, to understand exactly what goes on in all the different possible densities of materials.
All right. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Pamela. I really appreciate that. And we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good, Fraser. I'll talk to you later.
This has been Astronomy Cast, a weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos. Show notes and transcripts for every episode are available on our website. Check it out at astronomycast.com. You can send us any comments, questions, or feedback to info@astronomycast.com. We read every email. The show is a nonprofit educational resource provided by Fraser Kane and Dr. Pamela Gay. We're supported through the kind donations of listeners like you. If you enjoy Astronomy Cast, why not give us a donation? It helps us pay for bandwidth, transcripts, and show notes. Just click the donate link on the website. All donations are tax deductible for U.S. taxpayers. You can support the show for free, too. Write a review or recommend it to your friends. Every little bit helps. Click support the show on our website to see some suggestions. To subscribe to the show, point your podcatching software at astronomycast.com/podcast.xml or subscribe directly from iTunes. Music is provided by Travis Searle. The show was edited by Preston Gibson. Astronomy Cast is produced at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, with generous support from Universe Today.